So I thought that it would be nice to have an idea what actually we are talking about. And so I searched YouTube and I found this simulation. It also shows some physical quantities at the bottom, like magnetization and stuff like that. I don't really trust those things. But anyway, so let's run the simulation and let's see what's happening here. So you see that on the right-hand side, you have, you know, how above at critical temperature you are. So you are at the critical temperature here, and this is still above that. But you see the fluctuations of the spin. And as you keep decreasing the temperature, of course, at any constant temperature, the spins would be still fluctuating. But you see that actually some, you know, bigger and bigger blocks of ordered spins are forming as you are getting close to critical temperature. And so what we should observe exactly at a critical temperature is that the spins form blocks that are basically of infinite size. They are of the size of the system. And of course, exactly at critical temperature, you should see the same number of spins up and the same number of spins down, because the total magnetization is equal to zero. But you could also see, if I stop it, so now we are a little bit below, but you should also see that the thing has a fractal structure. So actually, if you are exactly at t equal to tc, then not only the number of spins up and down are equal, not only the blocks of ordered spins are actually infinite or of the size of the system, but also if you zoom out of the system or zoom in the system, you should actually observe exactly the same pattern. And this is what makes phase transitions quite difficult, or easy if you want, is that really exactly at phase transition, the normal dimensional analysis as you know it sort of breaks down. You can develop anomalous dimensions, fractal dimensions of the system. And so exactly at TC, it doesn't really matter which scale you have. You have basically the thing is described by CFT. And so you know that it's scale invariant theory. And so this is actually what's happening exactly at that. And then if we continue the simulation, of course, now the magnetization, we are below the critical temperature. So the magnetization should actually develop. So I don't really trust this thing. So now really you should be start developing the magnetization, which is non-trivial. And so one of the spins up is now, let's say, more than the spins down. But you see that still you have these huge blocks of things. Of course, eventually this finishes at 0.9 of t critical. But if you reduce all the way to t equal to zero, then one of the spins would completely disappear, and you would have everything ordered with spin up. And so there is now a lecture which we don't need. So very good. So now we can read about these things and about the fractal physics. So this is a popular article with some. So here's Wilson. We will start discussing Wilsonian renormalization tomorrow. But really, the fractals, as you know them, they really appear during the phase transition. And so not really like this, but really, no matter how you zoom in or zoom out, that's what's happening at t critical. And so there are some also things Wilson said when he was getting his Nobel Prize. So I encourage you to read this article. So now if you look at the papers I gave you, so basically this is what you would see there. And so this was really the beginning of renormalization due to Kadanov. And so Kadanov did the renormalization in the real space. And he was really the father of renormalization. So he noticed that if you are at t critical, then no matter how you zoom in or zoom out, you still see the same thing here. So what he was proposing is that let's take the system, let's cut it into, let's say, four things, and let's replace each thing with the color which is prevailing in that. This is not true. Okay, so I have small blocks. Let's say I have 2x2 blocks, and I look which spin is prevailing in that 2x2 block. And then I say, well, I replace these 2x2 blocks with one block, and that one which is prevailing originally. And so then the system actually is now has 4 times less blocks than it had at the beginning, but it has sort of the same structure. And so you keep repeating this, so you keep repeating and making smaller and smaller number of blocks. But if you are exactly at the critical, then actually you still see basically the same thing. However, if you are below T critical, then of course one of the spins is prevailing. And so if that is true, then in the end I will have everything black. Okay? And so this is really the origin of renormalization. We will study that next week. It's the real space in renormalization where you are replacing the blocks of your system with a new block, which is like, let's say, 4 to 1 or whatever, making the system zooming out of the system if you want. Karanov wasn't awarded a Nobel Prize for this, although he was really the first one to come up with this idea, but Wilson was. And so basically Wilson, as we will see tomorrow, did basically the same thing, but now in the momentum space. And the reason why he got the Nobel Prize and Karanov did not is that it's much more practical to do it in momentum space. And you can sort of keep track of what is really important and what you can throw away in your calculation, whereas you cannot really do it if you are doing the real space renormalization. And so the momentum space renormalization much more practical, and that's why actually he got the Nobel Prize in the end. Okay, so that's this picture. Now there's another popular website, if you want, where you can read about phase transitions. So now if I return back to what I gave you here, so this is precisely what's happening. So above TC, we have basically the spins randomly ordered and no average magnetization. Now at TC, you form these infinite blocks of ordered spins and the fractal structure. And then below TC, of course, one of the spins is prevailing. So that's why you have average magnetization, which is non-trivial. And the other one is gradually disappearing. Okay. And so here is the idea of block spin RG. And as I said, we will discuss that on Monday, but only after we discuss the momentum one, which is more practical. Okay. Are there any questions? Yes.
Why is the T greater than TC picture? Why is it not also a fractal?
Why is it also not fractal? Fractal. Well, it is also. Well, let's see. So the basic distinguish. So how to distinguish this picture from that picture? Really, the main idea is that here you have random things, but yeah, I would say that if you start zooming out, what would you see? You would just see gray mass, I think. So here, if I zoom out, I would see gray thing because I couldn't really distinguish the various spins. But I don't have big enough blocks of ordered spins, but here I do. So I don't think it's actually fractal. So here it's completely random, whereas here it's fractal. Other questions? All right, so thank you so much. Can you get this up, please? And so what I just said is the basis for introducing a very important, thank you, very important quantity, which is called spin-spin correlation function. And okay, so now spin-spin correlation function. And so this is defined basically, at what distance the spins are still correlated. And so it's given by sigma I minus average of sigma I times sigma j minus average of sigma j. And it's the same thing as sigma I, sigma j, average of them minus sigma I, sigma j. Okay, so this is known as spin-spin correlation function. And it really measures, how big the blocks, if you want, are in our system, of ordered spins. Okay, so now this is a very, very important quantity. And you can derive a beautiful formula, which I will just state here. And the reason why I just state whatever you get when you calculate these things is that the calculation is a little bit long, and it's not very illuminating. So if you are interested in any statistical physics textbook, the derivation is on a couple of pages. But I'll already do one long derivation today, so I thought that two derivations would be too much. Okay, so anyway, so just an idea. So to calculate this, there's a good trick. Is that you say, well, now I couple my Ising model to a magnetic field. However, the magnetic field, which can vary from side to side in the lattice. So then you have Bi, sigma I. And so Bi can be different at different I's. So you couple the magnetic field, which is spatially varying as you go through that lattice, and then you can show that this spin correlation function is simply given by a derivative of the free energy with respect to these BIs, dBi, dBj. Of course, in the end, you want to set the magnetic field equal to zero. So this you can show, and that's the trick how to calculate the spin-spin correlation function. Well, it's not really clear why you can do it. It will take several lines. But obviously, if I differentiate this guy with respect to Bi, I get sigma I, and I get sigma j here. So maybe it's something like that. Okay, so of course, I would have to first calculate the partition function, then the free energy, and then do this derivative here. So anyway, so what? Now I said a couple of pages, probably, well, at least two pages of calculations. And so we would find here. So if you are really interested, so as I said, either you can look at the statistical physics, any statistical physics textbook, or if you really want me to, I can write some appendix in the study text and you know, copy it from the statistical physics textbook. Unless you really want me to, I would prefer not to. So anyway, so what you get is that this is given by some positive constant here, 2 pi kappa, which is not very important. But what is important is that it exponentially decays as the distance between the two sides. And this exponential decay is weighted by a characteristic distance, xi. And then there is also this Coulomb-like decay, and so this is what you would find in the mean field theory. So mean field theory here. So it would basically be something which is not very important, some constant, positive constant here, and then it would look like a Yukawa potential if you want. So if I have just this equal to 1, then I would have Coulomb potential. But if I have this exponential decay, it means that something is massive there, if you want. And so there's this exponential decay as well. And so this xi is given by, again, some constant, 2 times t minus tc. Okay. So xi is the correlation length. So this guy is the correlation length. And it basically measures, you know, well, how big the blocks are. And so you see that this correlation length, as you approach t equal to tc, actually diverges. So this is precisely, so it means that you will have logs of the size of the system. Okay, so this guy, as you go to t equal to tc, diverges. And this is the spin-pin two-point correlation function. So now, more generally, if you go beyond mean field theory, you would find that, of course, so this is just a function of the distance between the two. So it's a function of r if I take the distance in the lattice. So more generally, you would find that g of r is proportional to now e to minus r over xi divided by r to d minus 2 plus eta. So this is what you would generally find, where this xi will be proportional to t to minus nu. Okay? And so this introduces two more critical exponents. So one of them is the critical exponent nu. Which is the critical exponent for the correlation length. So nu, the critical exponent for correlation length. And so it's the prediction of the mean field theory if you compare whatever the calculation would give you there. That nu is actually equal to 1/2. So mean field theory gives you that nu is equal to 1/2. So it correctly predicts that the correlation length actually diverges. But again, this will not be the correct answer for rising model, let's say, in three dimensions. And the other critical exponent is this eta here. And that's called anomalous dimension. And of course, so based on the dimensional analysis, you would expect that, this has to go like r to d minus 2 if you are in d dimensions. So we know that the Coulomb law is 1 over r2, r square, if you are in our normal world. But the presence of this eta actually tells you, well, if you are near criticality, actually, this is not true, and the dimensional analysis is a little bit wrong. And you can pick up some extra dimensions from the fractal structure, which is building up. And this is related. This is described by this anomalous dimension critical exponent. Okay. Are there any questions? Yes.
Is eta usually positive or negative?
This is a good question. Eta is. We will derive that even in the first approximation, it will be 0. I don't know if it's positive or negative. I think it can be both, but yeah. Other questions? So anyway, so what is true that xi diverges? So at t equal to tc, psi diverges. And we have observed a fractal structure. And so no matter how we zoom in or zoom out, the system is described by CFT. By quantum field theory, which is a theory, quantum field theory, which does not have scale, basically. So now, the pictures which we have seen before. So if you are at t bigger than tc, you know that you have completely random things. So some spins are up, some spins are down. Okay, and so you have really, really small things. So there is no ordered blocks of anything. So this is completely random configuration. Configuration and the average magnetization is 0. if you are decreasing the temperature and then you are at T equal to Tc, and suddenly you have big blocks which extend all the way through the system. So our magnetization is still equal to zero, but we have the fractal structure. And so we have these infinite blocks because psi goes to infinity according to this critical exponent nu. And so now if you are at t smaller than t critical, but still bigger than zero, then now you have big blocks which are of the, so mostly let's say you have ordered thing up, but you have still small regions where it is down, but mostly it is up. And so let's say the average magnetization is already something like one, but there are still some regions where you can have spin down. So by the way, okay, and finally, if you are at t equal to zero, then everything is ordered. So then you have one big block of ordered things, and sigma is equal to one. So this is what really is happening during our phase transition. So now you may be asking, what is really the meaning of psi here? And it really measures how big these blocks are. So this would be the psi here. This would be the psi here. And then it sort of switches. So whereas it was measuring, let's say, psi was measuring the size of the spins up, if you are bigger than t critical, if you are smaller than t critical, it actually measures the size of the blocks which are going now down. Okay, so the behavior of psi as t goes to t critical goes something like this. So it diverges exactly at t critical. Both blocks of spin up or spin down are infinite, but it is defined in such a way that in one case it measures, let's say, spin ups, and in the other one it measures spin down, sort of subtracts the average, what's happening there. And so that's why it goes to zero on both sides, as you are much bigger than t critical or much smaller than t critical. And the way how it diverges at tc is governed by nu. Yes?
Just to be sure I'm not missing anything. This is not in the equal zone, right?
This is not?
Not in the equal zone. This does not have the equal zone.
So this was like a 3D thing. Yeah. So, yeah. All right. So just remember, we can introduce two more critical exponents, eta and nu. And so by mean field theory, I didn't write it down, sorry for that. So in mean field theory, of course, this eta is equal to zero, as you get by comparing with that. Okay, so the mean field theory critical exponents, if you want, are really, really nice and simple. So just a summary, and they basically describe everything you need to know in field theory. So alpha, which describes the behavior of specific heat, is equal to zero. Beta is equal to 1/2. Gamma equals to 1. Delta equals to 3. Anomalous dimension equals to 0. And critical, correlation length equals to 1/2. So this is the mean field theory prediction. To correct these, we will try in the next three lectures. So now this seems that you have many critical exponents, actually, and all of them are independent, so that's not true. You can show that there is some, based on some very, very generic arguments, you can basically show that for typical systems, only two out of these critical exponents are indeed independent. And we will discuss that a little bit in tutorial, and I'll review that again tomorrow. But there is many relations named after famous people which actually relate these critical exponents. You have many algebraic equations which connect them. And in the end, typically only two are independent. So only two are independent. So that's good, because then it means that actually if you calculate two correctly, then you can actually calculate the rest just using those algebraic relations. However, it may happen that these algebraic relations are not always valid. Okay, so they are derived based on some assumptions. These assumptions typically seem very, very reasonable, but in practice they may be violated. Okay, questions? Okay, if there are no questions, so let me return back what we did yesterday. So we want to recast our problem of calculating the partition function and study the corresponding phase transition for the Ising model. And so the trick was that, of course, this is what you want to calculate as in standard terms. So you have just sigma I and then e to 1/2 t here, and then jij sigma I sigma j. So this is your partition function for the Ising model. And then you use the trick of Gaussian integration. And you just rewrite this exponential in terms of a Gaussian integral over some auxiliary fields phi 1 and 2 phi n. And so what you find is that, well, I'll not repeat. So we found that there's something here, 1 over determinant of this matrix J, and then square root of that, and 1 over 2 pi t to power n half, and then this does sum over all possible sigma i's, and then an integral, which is a multidimensional integral, d phi 1 to d phi n, and then e minus 1 over 2 t phi I j I j minus 1 phi j, and then plus 1 over t sigma I phi I. So this is what we found when we actually employed this multidimensional Gaussian integral. And so we noticed that, well, you still have to do the sum over sigma I, but we started with something which had these two spin interactions. However, by doing the trick of this Gaussian integration, you find that suddenly the only place where the spins actually appear is this one here. So suddenly you turn that into a one-spin interaction, so to a one-body problem. And so these spins are now interacting with these fields phi. Okay, so now this is an interaction of spin with field psi, rather than one with another. Okay, and so this may remind you the mean field theory, where we said, well, we are removing the multi-particle interactions by actually having an interaction, one-point interaction, with the external field. And of course, that external field was, in our case, the average magnetization. So this suggests that phi may something be like the M However, you just have to remember that M, when we said that M was the average mean field, the same everywhere in the lattice, then he said, yeah, so that's just a constant, and it was an approximation. Here, this is an exact equality. There is no approximation involved. Okay, so far this is completely exact, but just, you know, recalling what we have done for mean field theory, we may be thinking about a field phi, something like a magnetization with which each spin interacts. And of course, you see immediately the advantage, whereas this here was a constant. So now this guy is actually a variable field. And so this was precisely the disadvantage was that you said, well, I replaced it with a constant, and that's what actually gives you the wrong critical exponents. And then when you said, maybe, well, if we allow this to fluctuate, then it will be correct. And this is precisely what's happening here. So by the way, this is, as we said yesterday, this is just an analytic function. So we just set it equal to 1 because we don't care about analytic functions when we study the critical phenomena. And of course, now we can do the sum over these sigma i's because it's just an exponential linear thing. And so you end up with this beautiful prescription that set is now an integral of d phi e to minus s of phi, where this s of phi is given by 1 over 2t phi I jij minus 1 phi j. And then if you do the sum, of course, for each of these things, you pick up a cosine h. And if you want to write it as an exponential, it's exponential of logarithm of cosine h. That's minus I logarithm 2 times cosine h phi I over t. Okay, so this is our partition function written now as a multidimensional integral over these auxiliary fields phi. However, maybe these fields phi actually have physical meaning of a magnetization. Okay, so now to make this a little bit more convincing that really phi is something like M, let me do the saddle point approximation, saddle point or WKB approximation. So this is still exact. I just so then you are finding where the action is actually minimized. Okay, so we want to minimize S. And so that will be our geometric optics approximation or WKB approximation. So we want ds over d phi I. And then let's call the final solution, let's call it phi I average. And so this must be equal to 0. So that's our condition that the action is stationary. OK, so now if you do it, then I just have to differentiate this respect to phi. I have quadratic thing here, so this y 1/2 disappears. And this is 1 over t j I j minus 1 phi j. And then I have to differentiate the logarithm. So I'm getting cosine h at the bottom and sine h there. So it's minus 1 over t tangens h phi I over t. OK, so now you multiply. So this is an inverse of jij matrix. So now you can multiply both sides with jij, well, jik. And then, of course, this will just give you 1, and that will give you jik there. So then it's not surprised that from here, you're finding that phi I, well, what else it can be, is just sum over j, jij, tangens h, ij over t. Okay? Just multiplying both sides by j, this is what you are finding. However, in this approximation, all these lattice sides are the same. So that's why phi 1 equals to phi 2 equals to phi. So all the lattice points are the same. So then I just replace this phi j with just phi here. And then I can sum over jij, which just gives me the j without an index. Okay, so then you're finding that phi is equal to j times tangens h phi over t. So now, if you make a comparison with what we have seen before, we have seen an equation something like m is tangens h m over t, jm over t probably, jm over t. So now, if you compare this with that, you see that actually phi, if you make an identification that phi is mj, then you return back to the mean field theory. Okay. So in some sense, so this is just a simple calculation showing you that we have this exact expression for the partition function. And we can always, of course, recover some approximations. And in particular, the mean field theory approximation, which we had before, is recovered by taking just the leading order, the WKB approximation of this expression here. So mean field theory is actually corresponds to WKB approximation. Okay, so that's the leading order. Of course, now we want to go beyond the leading order because we know that mean field theory is good, but not good enough. Questions? Everybody looks sleepy today. Okay, so before we go further, so what we want to do next is, if you look at this partition function z, we have these fluctuating fields phi's, and so there's phi 1 to phi n. So these are already, they may remind you field theory, right? But of course, the field theory typically lives. So this is a classical field theory. There's nothing quantum here. We started with a classical system, classical model of the Ising system. And so we have a classical field theory here. However, even the classical field theory typically is defined in a continuum space-time, right? However, here, if the fields are labeled by index I, that means that the fields so far still live only on the lattice points. Okay, so fields phi I are confined to lattice points. So that means that, yeah, we have something like a field theory, but this is really a discrete space-time, if you want. So now, what we would like to do, and what will be calculationally easier, is to do a continuous limit, right? So what does it mean, continuous limit? So continuous limit means that I could achieve a continuous limit by saying, well, if I look at the system from very, very far away, actually, I don't see the lattice spacing. So this thing A will, you know, all the spins will go together as I move away from it, and I will see it nice and continuous. Okay. However, can I afford to go away? What do you think? Can I actually zoom out of the system? Well, not if I am very, very far away from the critical temperature. But if I am close to the critical temperature, you have the fractal structure. And so actually for the spins. So then actually if I move away, you know, nothing changes with the picture of the spins. But the lattice, of course, diminishes and eventually disappears, and I have continuous thing. So now the idea is that close to critical temperature, we can zoom out of the system. Which effectively makes the system continuous. So it's a continuous limit. Where effectively, really, the lattice disappears. Okay, and so that's our next step. And so, of course, as a result, in the end, we will recover just a standard classical field theory living in a continuous space. So just, you know, forgetting that this is only defined at the lattice points. Okay, so to do that, we'll take some work. And it will not be very rigorous work. So I'll be throwing away all the terms which I don't want. And I'll be doing all the things which you will not like. So let's start doing that. So we have our action, which is written over there. It's just 1 over 2t, phi I, j, I, j, phi j, and then logarithm. So now remember, if phi is something like m, then close to the critical point, this must be small. Okay, so if you plot the graph how m depends on the temperature, m is small close to the critical point. So I can definitely do expansion in small m or in small phi. So the first step is very, very simple. You just take logarithm 2 times cosine h phi over 2. And yeah, you just do the Taylor expansion. So logarithm 2, not interesting. It's just a constant, 1 half phi I over t square minus 1 over 12 phi I over t to power 4, and so on. So this is what you are getting by expanding in phi, phi I here. OK, because close to critical point, phi I has to be small. So now this is just a constant, so you're not interested in that. Second term, we will see what it gives us. But the third one, there's this important minus 1 over 12. And that 1 over 12 is not that important. But the minus is important, as we will see later on. Okay, so this minus, just keep in mind that this is important. Okay, so that's the second term. And that's easy to deal with. It just gives us this power series in phi. So now, in order to deal with the first term, I have to at least touch on this horrible thing, which is the lattice Fourier transform. So everybody's familiar with Fourier transform. You can go from X space to K space or B space. So now there's an analogous version of this for a lattice. Let me just state the formulas, which you will have to believe me. But they are not, you know, they are quite intuitive. So lattice Fourier transform So it's very simple. So if I have something which is in the real space defined on a point I in the lattice, then I can write the corresponding thing as sum over all possible q's. And then this would be my momentum version of that phi. And then e q times RI. Okay, so this is what you would expect. Something like Fourier series, but yeah, now it's on the lattice. N is, of course, the number of lattice points. So now what is beautiful is that if you have something which depends only on the difference between RI and RJ, then you can still write it as a simple sum over 1Q. So in principle, you would have to Fourier transform each index separately, but because this only depends on the difference between the two, only on the difference between RI and RJ, then this is simply given by a nice formula, e to I q RI minus RJ. Okay, so this is good. So now for normal Fourier transform, if you want to go from X space to K space and you want to go the other way around, you need something like orthonormality conditions. So how to write delta ij, basically. And so these are given by orthonormality relations. And so 1 over n, one of them is if I sum over I to minus, and that's not the I, that's sum over j, minus I, k minus k prime times rj. Okay, so then you get that this is equal to delta k and k prime, as you would expect. And similarly, if you sum over k, so you have 1 over n, sum over q, and then e to minus I q ri minus rj, and this is delta ij. Okay? So this is all we need to know about the lattice Fourier transform in order to motivate the result. And okay. Medium and fine. Are there any questions so far? Everything is simple. Yes?
I don't understand why you're saying that the theory defined by this partition function is a classical field theory, not a quantum field theory.
Sorry? Can you say it again?
I don't understand why you're saying that the theory defined by this partition function is a classical field theory, not a quantum field theory.
Well, everything is classical here. There's nothing quantum here. So we have classical statistical system. It's a term. So all the fluctuations here are thermal fluctuations. So everything is the standard statistical physics, not quantum statistical physics. If you want what we are doing here. So we will see that. So we are getting something like a pass integral formulation. But here there is nothing quantum here.
But I can totally think about this partition function as a quantum field theory and do everything as if I were in a quantum field theory, right?
Yeah, the formalism is exactly the same. Yeah. Formalism is exactly the same, but there's really nothing quantum here. That's what I'm saying.
These letters for a transmit are in 2D, right?
So this is in NAD.
Wouldn't you get different vectors from
the
N? Volume, right?
Yeah, n is the total number of particles as the volume here. you can probably normalize it differently. Yeah.
So when you say there is nothing quantum, you're just saying that the h bar we have in QFT is going to be something like the temperature, something like that.
Sorry? So here everything is just given by the temperature. There is no h bar here.
Given these correspondences.
Yeah. If you wanted to translate it to quantum, yeah. So formally, this is exactly the same as you would do in quantum theory. As you will see, you'll be drawing Feynman diagrams as you do in quantum field theory. But yeah, if you really want, but what you can do is that you can typically translate the quantum mechanical problem to a classical problem in one dimension higher. Okay, so I will not demonstrate that. But there's all, you know, typically you can map quantum mechanical problem to a classical problem to increase the number of dimensions.
Classical problem, you mean a thermal classical problem?
Yeah. Thermal classical problem can be mapped to a problem in quantum less, one less dimension.
Okay.
But I'll not be doing that. So here we have classical field theory. Okay, so now boring stuff. So now we want to deal. So let's deal with the term. With the term Jij phi I Jij minus 1 phi j. And of course, there is a sum over I and j. Okay, so this is the term which we have to deal with in order to write down that thing here. And of course, the trick is to Fourier transform everything. So first, we Fourier transform this field phi, then we Fourier transform this guy, and then we Fourier transform that guy. So this is sub over I and j, and then 1 over n, sum over q, phi q, e to I q times ri. So that's we just Fourier transform phi i. This is our phi I. Then we Fourier transform j. This is 1 over n, sum over q prime, j minus 1 of q prime, e to I q prime, r I minus r j. Using that formula and the fact that jij only depends only on the distance between r I and r j. So this is jij minus 1. And then finally, you have 1 over n, sum over q double prime, and then phi q double prime e to I q double prime times rj, which is phi j. OK. So I was just using these things here. Now you want to use the orthonormality relation. So in particular, you have this sum over I and j at your disposal. So you have this sum here, I and j. And I want to use the first orthogonality relation here. So whenever I see k and k prime, well, it just gives me delta k prime. OK, so now if you look at what really depends on ri and rj, so on ri is this exponential here, and it's that exponential here. And then on rj is that exponential here and that exponential here. So now if I do the sum over ri, it just tells me that q and q prime are basically the same. Right? So sum over, now we sum over I and j. And so what we are getting here, and of course, that sum over j, it eats 1 over n factor, one of them. Okay, so now similarly, the sum over j will eat another 1 over n factor, and it will give me another delta function, but now between q double prime and q prime. Okay, so this is then equal to 1 over n, the only n which is left, and then we have sum over q prime, mq double prime, that's what we still have there. And then we have phi over q, and then j minus 1 q prime, and phi of q double prime. And then we have delta of q minus q prime, and delta of q prime and q double prime over the sum over I and j. So now this is beautiful, because you can kill two more sums. You can kill sum over q prime and q double prime by just using these delta things. And so you find that this is equal to 1 over n, sum over just one q. And then we know that q, OK, let's use, well, let's use q prime as new q. So then this one is minus q prime. So it's phi of minus q. and then j minus 1 of q, and then q double prime is q, so phi q. Okay, so this is what it is. And see, it's very simple, right? Very simple. And you probably do it in quantum theory all the time, right? You're killing some sums using autonomous relations and stuff like that. Okay, so what we have done so far is that we have written that sum which was in the real space to a sum which is now in the momentum space. Right? So this is what we have done. But in momentum space, it's sort of nicer because you have only one sum here over q, whereas you had two sums over I and j here. So in momentum space, it's nice. So now, to proceed further, you need to know what this j minus 1 of q is. Okay. So now let's do some approximations. Okay. So j minus 1 of q is, of course, 1 over j of q. So what is j of q? We know that, we plug it here, and we are done. So J of Q is, of course, a transform of our Jij. Q Ri minus Rj. Okay, so now we use the fact that we want to get a continuous limit. Okay, so physically, what we are really working towards is that we are zooming out of the system and we want the continuous limit of the lattice. Okay, so of course, if you are zooming out, you see larger and larger regions of your system. That means that in the position space, you have larger and larger distances, but in the momentum space, it means smaller and smaller q's. Okay, so then, of course, if q is small, so this is small because we want a continuum limit. Right, so if distances are large, q's are small. So then you can just expand the exponential in the Taylor series and q keep only a few terms. Okay, so then this is equal to 1 over n, sum over I and j, jij. And then I'm expanding the exponential, of course. So if q0 is just 1, and then why I have, there's a minus sign here. So minus I q times ri rj. That's the linear term. And then you have also the quadratic term. So it's minus 1 half, strange. OK, let me write that. Ri, Rj, square, and plus other terms. OK. So we are just doing the continuum limit. The momentum is small. So that's why we can do just first three terms in the momentum. OK, so the first term is quite simple, right? Just one, so you can do the sum over jij. So one sum just gives you j, and the other sum gives you n. OK, so here, this is equal to the 1 over n. And then sum over I and j, jij, which gives you just j. Then you have next term, which is linear in the momentum and in the positions, ri minus rj. Okay. So now look at this beauty. So if you look at this thing here, it's some tensor, let's call it A, which depends on index I and j. Okay. However, this tensor is, of course, antisymmetric. If I change I and j, because there's a minus sign between them, then I get a minus thing. So this is an antisymmetric tensor, but Jij is a symmetric one. So this is symmetric I and j. So now from relativity, you know that antisymmetric times symmetric is always equal to 0. So the linear term does not contribute. So it's plus 0. Okay, and now the devil here. So then we have minus 1 half, and then 1 over n, and then sum over I and j, and then jij, and then this thing here, q times ri minus rj square, and plus other terms. Okay, so now I'm not going to calculate this term. I'm just going to tell you that all you need to know is that this depends on q square, okay? Which obviously it does. So what people do is that they say this is actually equal to minus 1 half, and then they put everything together and they call it kappa, and then q squared. That's what is important. So in the end, your j of q is just given by j minus 1 half kappa q squared, and plus other terms which are not interesting. Okay. So now, of course, this kappa, it contains all the junk which is in there. And so what I'm really doing here is sort of like counting, you know, how many q's are there. So now what this kappa is, it's called spin stiffness. Spin stiffness. And it's not really important for us what it is. But you can see based on dimensional grounds that this kappa, well, so what is this guy? It's just it has dimensions of length square. Right? And so this will be non-trivial only if you are within the range of interaction. If Ri is much further away than Rj, then these two guys already don't interact. So this will approximately contribute only if you are within the range of the interaction. So kappa is something like range of the interaction square. And then you have this sum over Jij, which gives you something like j times n. And finally, actually, if you do it more properly, it also depends on the number of dimensions. So this is what the formula for kappa is. And it's the same kappa which appears in this calculation for the correlation function. Okay, so the kappa which I wrote there is precisely the spin stiffness which appears here. And it's given by the formula there. Okay. But if you want, this is just an estimate of what it could be. So what is really, really important is that there is no linear in Q contribution to this guy. So there's only zero order term, then there's Q square, and there will be other terms as well.
So there is a 1 over n in front of the
term. Yes, very good. There is 1 over n. Okay. So now I screwed it up probably. So certainly this guy gives you Jij is j times n. So this is what that, and I still should have 1 over n. So let's divide it. What am I using here?
I mean, so your kappa should not depend on n, right? Because
Yeah. So that must be divided by n here. You're right. Yeah. So no n. So I'm using this 1 over n here. And then, of course, sum over jij will give you j times n, but it cancels that n. So this is the thing. Thank you.
A few questions. One, where did that absolute value come from?
Where did that absolute value come from? No. This is just a square.
Okay.
It's just a square. But I'm saying, yeah, this is something like an absolute value of q squared.
Okay.
And
And then the other thing is, so why is Q small in the continuum of it?
Ah, so because you are probing larger and larger spaces. So you sort of have a duality between how large the space and how small momentum is. So if you want to probe smaller and smaller space, you need large momenta. So here you are using that. So but the other way around.
But Q can be anything, right? Like.
Yeah. Q can be anything.
Yeah.
So. In some sense, what you are really probing here is a low energetic things, right? So you're looking at the system as a whole, and so what really is important for the physics there is the small momenta.
So we'll only be looking at J and Q for small Q.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then one of the other things is, you know, it depends on like Q squared, not on the individual Qs.
Well, of course it could. It could. So this is just a, you know, very, very approximate estimate. So I'm basically doing a dimensional analysis. I see, you know, two Qs, so that's why I put Q square. I see two R. Yeah, so this is not, you know, this is not rigorous at all. But in the end, what it has to be is this thing here.
Is there like a mathematical reason Q should be small? Like, I don't.
That's a good question. I don't know. We maybe think about it if you'd give me a mathematical reason. So, you know, from physics point of view, it's you want to probe small energetic things, you want to probe large systems, but it's the small cues which are important for the phase transitions. Mathematically, I don't know. All right, so this is horrible derivation, but anyway, so we have what JQ is. So now we can use it over here. So remember, we are calculating this term here, that phi I j I j minus 1 phi j. And we found a formula in terms of the q here. So it's phi of q j minus 1 of q phi q. But now we know what j minus q is, j minus 1 of q is. OK, so let's put that together. So calculation of these things, of the correlation function, proceeds in similar ways. So that's why I thought one derivation is enough. Okay, so now we can split our S into S0 plus S interacting, where in S0, I put the first term, so S0 of phi, I just put the first term, which is 1 over 2t, 1 over 2t squared, sum over I and j, t times phi I, jij minus 1 phi j. So that's the first term. And then I put the quadratic term in phi from the second term. So this 1 half phi I square over t. Minus 1 half sum over I phi I square over t square. Okay, and then this S interacting will be the remaining term, which will be phi to the 4 term. Okay, so S interacting will be this minus 1 over 12, and then phi I to 4, sum over I, t to the 4. Okay, so I just define it in this way. So it's precisely the terms which we are getting here. So now this one here, okay, so you can write it as 1 over 2t squared And then if we go to the momentum space, there'll be this m. Okay. And sum over q, phi of minus q. So now I'm plugging the formula for that sum over I and j. So it's phi minus q. And then it will be t over j of q. That's what's written there. And then if you look at this guy here, it's just minus 1 phi of q. So the first term just gives me this guy here, so that formula there. And the second term is just phi square over t square, and it's precisely this minus 1 here. Okay. So now what is interesting is what is this inside? Okay, so it's t over, and then j of q, we are using this thing here that is just j minus 1 half kappa q square. Well, this is t over j 1 minus 1 half q square kappa over j. And then minus 1. Yeah, so I'm just using the formula for j of q. Oh, very good. So now this is small, if q is small. I'm just picking plus on so OK. So this is t over j times 1 plus 1 half q square kappa over j minus 1. So remember that we called, well, we know that in the mean field theory, j is equal to tc. Okay. So then you are, the first term is just t minus tc divided by tc. And then you have plus 1 half q square kappa t over tc square. Everybody happy? Hopefully it's correct. So now this is the definition of small t. And so we are learning that whatever stands here is small t plus something which is quadratic in Q. And what stands in front of that is a positive quantity, kappa t over tc square. Okay. So very good. So let's use it. So we have 1 over 2 t square n, and then sum over q, and then phi of minus q t, and then plus 1 half q square kappa t over tc square phi of q. Okay, so that's our S0 term. So now what you want to do, basically, you want to redefine your field phi so that you get rid of this chunk here. So you want to set is equal to 1, effectively, by saying, well, I redefine my field, so I absorb this 1 half kappa t over tc square into my field phi. Okay, so for that, if I have it correct, so you have to do a transformation that you go from phi to tc, oh no, 2d, and then r. Also, I want to have a lattice constant somewhere times phi. So do it as your homework if you want. And then you introduce a new variable, which is 2 times d number of dimensions times this small t times r square. Okay. So you are now using the fact that you can mess with whatever you see there. So you can mess with the field phi, but you can also introduce, instead of small t, you can introduce something which is proportional to small t. Okay, why not? So there's lots of freedom here. Okay, and so what we get out of this, and now I regret that I did the derivation at all, but hopefully at least something, you know, sticks into you. That is actually painful and not very rigorous. At least that's what you should remember from this derivation. All right. So then we have that S 0 of phi, if you do this redefinition of phi and you introduce this small r, then you find this is 1 half 1 over n a to power d sum over q phi of minus q and then r plus q square phi of q. Okay, so I redefine phi so that I have only q square here, and then in order I want to have some quantity here, just one quantity, and you have to redefine t to small quantity r. Okay, so now once you have that, this you can turn to an integral over q. Okay, so this will be an integral. So you are just giving that this is in the limit. This is just 1 over 2, and an integral d dq. 2 pi d, and then phi of minus q, r plus q square, phi of q. And then you can take the inverse transform if you want. So you know that if you have the Fourier transform, and if you have derivatives, then the derivatives just translate to the multiplication by the corresponding variable. So what is really written here is just a derivative of phi square with respect to the x coordinate and twice. Okay. So what is really written here is that this is 1 half an integral d dx of nabla phi square. That's the term which gives you and then plus r phi square. Okay. Well, this is what it is, just a momentum representation of this thing here. Okay, so that was the S0. Now I'll not do it, and it's wrong in the lecture notes anyway. So now, S integration of phi, you can show that it's actually equal to, well, it's something like phi to the 4, and something with a minus sign there. Why is it a minus sign? Logarithm. Ah, very good. Oh. If you look at that S action there, it's actually minus sum over I logarithm of these things. So if you have minus, then actually it would be plus 1 over 12. So this was wrong. This is like plus 1 over 12. Yeah, here. So it's something which is positive times phi to the 4. And so it's not surprising that in the end, you can just write it as an integral d4x. And then something which is positive, let's call it something which is positive u over 4 factorial. Why not? And then phi to the 4. Okay. So in the end, what we have derived, not really, is that our total action is S of phi in the continuum limit. The action just looks like d dx and then 1 half nabla phi square and then plus r over 2 phi square plus u over 4 factorial phi to the 4. Okay, if you put everything together, this is what you have in the continuum limit. Yes?
Let's say again.
Sorry, what is? What?
A.
A. So here A is the lattice spacing. So when I'm actually putting this thing here, A to the D, that's the volume which we were looking for. So maybe, yeah. So A to the D is just the volume of the lattice. And so this is like a measure which I'm using. How I change the summation over Q to an integration over Q is that you divide by the volume.
And where did the lattice spacing show up?
So the lattice spacing, well, not really, it didn't. So you can divide by A to the D, and you can multiply by A to the D. So if you multiply by A to the D, it's precisely Yeah, so when I was redefining the field, I wanted to have in the end this A to the D here so that I would have 1 over volume. And so it comes from the definition of the field.
And all these factors that would show up in the interaction part, you absorbed in the definition of U.
Yeah, if you want. Yes, exactly. So what you are finding here, so this is the final thing. I absorb everything into these R and U. But what is obvious from the derivation is that R is proportional to T. Okay, so that's very important thing which comes out of the derivation. So in other words, changes sign as you cross TC. Okay, so that's one thing which is very important. Second thing which is important, if you look at where this U comes from, well, it's a positive 1 over 12, and then there are some factors of T to the 4, and there might be some factors of A and some factors of D, but doesn't matter. But in the end, the U is also positive. Okay, so that's another thing which you can notice from the derivation if you do all the painful steps. Okay, oh, very good. So now this functional here is called Landau-Ginzburg functional. Well, this is Landau-Ginzburg. And it will be our starting point when we do the renormalization. Okay? So now, if you forget about the Nabla phi square term, you have something which is phi square plus something which is phi to the 4. So maybe you remember the form of the free energy yesterday, and then we discussed the Landau's theory. So this was precisely, we had like expansion something m square plus something m to the 4. So if this term is not here, this would actually be the Landau functional. And you will see it in today's tutorial. Now, all the thing which is actually improved by Ginzburg is just adding the fact that the field actually can spatially fluctuate. So now you are adding this thing here. Okay. So now the last thing to notice is, of course, yeah, this is now a classical field theory. So you are getting something like a scalar field theory for your problem. However, this is in Euclidean space. There is no time direction here. So this is a field theory and if you want, with imaginary time. So there is no time direction in this field theory. Everything is just purely spatial. Okay, and so I don't have time to discuss anything more. But just, you know, so there's this horrible derivation. I don't want you to know anything about this horrible derivation. So the only what I want you to remember from here is that, yeah, you start with something which is an exact partition function, and then you want to take a continuum limit of this function. Because here, as defined, all the fields are only defined at lattice points. And so you want to zoom out of the system and make a continuum limit to forget about the lattice spacing. And if you do that, and so, as I said, it's like painful thing to do, but not and moreover, not very, very rigorous, you end up with a field theory, as you must, in a continuum space. But now this field theory, of course, it has to have it has to live only on the space. There's no time here. So that's why this is just ddx. There is no dt here. And then if you forget the fluctuations, you sort of return back to Landau's theory. So this was really the main thing which Ginzburg added and which made these things complete and nice. Questions? Sorry for this long derivation. Well, see you in the afternoon then.